faced extreme poverty and discrimination. The UK even handed one of the islands, Diego Garcia, over to the US, which then fully militarized it by developing a base there.
A lawyer for the indigenous inhabitants of Diego Garcia elaborates here on how they were tricked and later evicted to pave way for the illegal US military base.
It was entirely improper, unethical, dictatorial to have the Chagossian put the thumbprint on an English legal drafted document where the Chagossian, who doesn't read nor speak any English, let alone legal English, is made to renounce basically all his rights as a human being.
Back to Mr. Hammond. Now, how is the United States facilitating the continued colonization of Chagos Islands by Britain?
Well, the United States and Britain are, you know, partners in crime all over the world. They're very close. Clearly, it's in the interests of Britain, as the base was built by the United States. Britain has complete access to it. It's joint staging ground for the both of them. So it's not like the United States is twisting anybody's arm to get Britain to support our operations there or allow the United States to continue operations there. It also should be mentioned that the Chagos Archipelago is rich in oil and gas deposits. And, you know, clearly part of Mauritius government seeking to take control of its own territory is based around, for example, Jean-Raymond Bouel, who is one of the most powerful individuals in the world. American Mineral Fields International was one of his mining companies that operated in the Congo, very close to the Clinton family. And, you know, they want control of the oil and natural gas, and they'll do anything to get it.
The African Union urged Britain to comply with the UN resolution and reiterated the AU's support for a complete decolonization of the Chagos Islands. In his address to the UN General Assembly, Prime Minister of Mauritius reiterated his call for Britain to stop its colonization of Chagos Islands.
Mr. President, it remains a matter of concern that more than 2 years after the International Court of Justice ruled that the decolonization process of Mauritius has not been lawfully completed in view of the unlawful accession of the Chagos Archipelago from its territory prior to independence, and that the United Kingdom has an obligation to withdraw its unlawful administration from the Chagos Archipelago as rapidly as possible, we still see no action on the part of the colonial power. And yet, the findings of the ICJ have been affirmed by the UN General Assembly Resolution 73/295. And in January this year, a special chamber of ITLOS has held that those authoritative determinations of international law by the ICJ have binding legal effect, rendering it beyond legitimate dispute that Mauritius is sovereign over the Chagos Archipelago as an integral part of its national territory.
The people of Chagos have been relentless in fighting for decolonization of their islands and their reunification with the Republic of Mauritius. Now, most international legal channels have been exhausted, and Britain is adamant on continuing its occupation of Chagos Islands, the last remaining colony of the British Empire. Now, Mr. Hammond, our last question to you. What options remain for the people of Chagos to liberate their territory?
Well, clearly the Chagosian people have rights that have been trampled on, beginning with their forcible exile, removal back, you know, from 1966 to 1971. We're only talking about, you know, a thousand people at the time. You know, apparently their families have grown substantially. So that's, you know, it's not a large number of people, but they still have rights to this territory. Again, the United States, Britain, Israel don't care about international law. They don't care about humanitarian law. The politics of genocide are such that we commit, our governments commit crimes anytime they like, pretty much, and get away with it. And so the Chagosian people, the only real recourse that they have is to get the word out. I mean, if Americans who are opposed to the war, opposed to American military, permanent military operations, our permanent warfare economy, if the United States people and the Canadian people and the European people and Australians could stand up against the system and realize that Diego Garcia, this military base, is the most important base in the region, shutting down that base and returning the land to the Chagosian people would be a huge, huge win for peace in the world.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hammond, for your insight on efforts to liberate Chagos Islands currently illegally occupied by Britain. Now, there you have it. The liberation of Chagos Islands will require international support. Well, our time is up for today. Goodbye for now.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Thank you for joining us here today. Today on The Key, we're going to be looking at a very important and pertinent question, which is related to the blessed month of Ramadan that we're in, which is the month of the Quran, the month of the revelation of the Quran. And it is very pertinent, especially for us human beings who live in this world today. And that is, the question is, what does the Quran have to say about health and well-being? Right now we're talking about health and well-being, both from a spiritual and from a physical point of view. What does the Quran have to say about this? And, you know, this is very pertinent for us today, because right now we're going through this pandemic, and a lot of people are scared. People are turning to this cure, that cure, the vaccine, other kinds of alternative medicines. A lot of time people ask, does the Quran have anything to say about this or health, good health in general or not? Right, so this is something that we want to examine today and see if we can come with any definitive answer regarding this question. Before we begin, examining in detail what the Quran says, in general we can say that good health and being free of diseases has always been one of those concerns of human beings ever since, human beings have been on the face of this earth. And the Quran, the Quran al-Karim, the noble Quran, it's not a book about health, right? The Quran is a book about guidance. It's about spiritual guidance. It's supposed to lead human beings to their spiritual felicity in this world and in the hereafter. It's a book of salvation for human beings. At the same time, it is nevertheless true that human beings are not just, spirits floating out there, right? It's true that, a human being's core, his essence, is his spirit. But nevertheless, this spirit is connected to this body, to a body. And the body has an effect on the spirit, and vice versa, the spirit has effect on the body, right? So there is no doubt that sickness, physical sickness, physical illness, right, it has an effect on our spiritual well-being, right? You know, a lot of the urafa, a lot of the mystics, a lot of the spiritual masters, they have compared the body to a mount, right? To a steed or a horse, which a rider, who being the spiritual wayfarer, uses to, you know, arrive at a certain a place, a certain spiritual position, right? So like this Gethsemane is riding on a horse, right? And that horse, he wants to get certain to a certain place. If the horse is sick, obviously he can get there. So these urafa, these mystics, they are very, they tell their disciples, their students, you know, they give them specific instructions to take care of their body, to take care of their physical well-being. All right, so this is one matter that we should take into consideration. At the same, so this is something that we should take into consideration. The Quran Kareem, the Noble Quran, mentions sickness in many places, in many verses, and in many surahs, and many of its chapters. It refers to it by words such as suqum, or saqim, zarar, right, or marla, right? These are Arabic words and terms that the Quran uses and references to physical health, physical illness and maladies, right? So the Quran does pay importance to this, and it's not that the Quran has nothing to say about this, even though it's not its main concern, and it uses it as a stepping stone to spiritual well-being. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at what the Quran has to say about spiritual wellness and physical wellness. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable Discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
National Day of Nuclear Technology. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. April 9, 2006 was the day in which Iran announced achievement of uranium enrichment technology and a start of the full enrichment cycle in Natanz, central Iran. It was a turning point in the history of the Islamic Republic's endeavor in the field of peaceful nuclear technology. Following this success, the country entered the club of countries possessing the uranium enrichment know-how and technology. In view of this, the day was named as the National Day of Nuclear Technology to appreciate and glorify the efforts of young Iranian scientists. The Islamic Republic of Iran has covered a very arduous course to achieve nuclear technology. In 1958, Iran became a member of the International Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA, and in 1968 signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, NPT, which was ratified in the Iranian parliament in 1970. In 1967, the United States had sold the first research 5-megawatt light water reactor to Iran for producing radio medicines. The American company AMF installed the reactor and put it into action in Tehran University. It was also committed to provide the 20-megawatt fuel needed by the reactor. Iran's Atomic Energy Organization has taken over the reactor and the fuel bars are made indigenously. According to the studies, with construction of nuclear power plants, over 20 megawatts of electricity are to be produced from nuclear energy. According to the reports, Iran had planned in 1974 to indigenize the full nuclear cycle within 20 years and provide 23 megawatts of electricity via 22 power plants. In view of this, contracts were concluded with Germany and France. Germany started construction of two 1,000-megawatt reactors in Bushehr in 1970s, but it gave up the job after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, despite 85% progress. France, too, started construction of 360-megawatt reactor in Darhuen in Khuzestan province in 1970s, which was left unfinished after the victory of the Islamic Revolution. After the victory of the Islamic Revolution and establishment of the Islamic Republic, the U.S. and its regional accomplices made broad efforts to overthrow the Islamic Republic, which culminated in the imposed war, which lingered for 8 years. Iran's peaceful nuclear activities were also affected by the war, and more than a decade the program was halted. The Western regimes not only failed to fulfill their commitment to finishing the nuclear plants, they also assisted Iraq in bombarding these facilities, especially that of Bushehr. Thus, the nuclear plant inflicted serious damages. But from 1989, the first steps were taken for the revival of the peaceful nuclear program. The Islamic Republic of Iran considered Russia as a substitute for Germany, and in 1994, the contract was signed between the two countries to finish and put into action the nuclear plant in Bushehr. In 1998, the contract was revised, and the facility entered the operational cycle of producing electricity in 2011 after several tests. In 2003, the ballyhoo of counter-revolutionary and anti-Iran Western media on Iran's efforts to achieve atomic weapons technology caused sensitivity of Europe and the U.S., urging them to halt Iran's peaceful nuclear activities with various pretexts. But in 2006, the Iranian scientists and experts reached a new generation of centrifuges and announced it to the IAEA, hence making the nation a member of the Club of Nations possessing uranium enrichment technology. The Iranian government signed some agreements with the European parties, which gradually led to suspension of its nuclear activities and even studies. In the first year of the next government, the Islamic Republic announced the end of voluntary suspension of enrichment and that it would continue the activities of Isfahan UCF facilities under the IAEA supervision. This caused the Western media horns to fabricate allegations on Iran's tilting toward military program, and finally the issue was sent to the United Nations Security Council. After many ups and downs on Iran's peaceful nuclear program and passing several resolutions to sanction Iran, numerous rounds of talks between Iran and the so-called 5 plus 1 The five self-imposed prominent members of the UNSC and Germany bore fruit in July 2015 in the form of an agreement. The agreement imposed unconventional limitations on Iran's activities, facilities, and substances, and remarkably increased the number of IAEA inspectors. Thus, Iran accepted to voluntarily implement the additional protocol, and the UN was committed to remove sanctions stipulated in the UNSC 2231 resolution. Iran and the 5+1 reached an agreement on July 14, 2015, which became famous as Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA. Contrary to Iran's good intention and full commitment to its JCPOA obligations, the U.S. has never kept its promises and commitments and has not removed even a single sanction against the country. Then, American President Donald Trump tore the agreement in front of TV cameras in May 2018 to show the U.S. unilateral approach in global issues. Washington has ever since imposed the harshest sanctions against Iran within the framework of the so-called maximum pressure. The remaining four European governments have bluntly obeyed the U.S. in failing to fulfill their JCPOA commitments. This made Tehran to decrease its nuclear commitments in five steps. In view of this, the Iranian parliament ratified the law for the government to take new steps to expand nuclear activities. Among these steps, mention can be made of the 20% uranium enrichment, putting forward the issue of the 60% enrichment, production of metal uranium, and expansion of nuclear facilities and equipment. The new approach by the Iranian parliament and government has seriously warned the U.S. and its accomplices and cohorts, especially the fake regime of Israel as the biggest possessor of atomic bombs and weapons in the region. The Islamic Republic of Iran has announced that it would return its JCPOA commitments if the U.S. removes all sanctions and returns to the deal. In spite of the fact that the Islamic Republic of Iran is pursuing a fully peaceful nuclear program, the United States and its European allies have resorted to the issue to accuse Iran of trying to achieve nuclear weapons. This allegation has many times been proved to be baseless by the IAEA inspectors and even the U.S. fair analysts and congressmen. Yet, in March 2021, the Biden administration issued a document known as Temporary Directive of National Security Strategy, in which the unfounded allegations have been repeated against Iran. In sum, it appears that the U.S. is scared of Iran's ability and power in every arena. Australian political expert Caitlin John Stone says Biden's policies on Iran are the same Trump policies on the country. The United States and its partners in crime, particularly the Zionist regime of Israel, are fully aware that Iran's nuclear program is completely peaceful. Yet, they are opposed to Iran's advancement in any field as they don't want the Islamic Iran to become a role model for other nations which seek freedom and independence.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, answer to an objection in reference to the holy month of Ramadan. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. How can Islam force someone to be hungry and thirsty? Is forcing okay in Islam? Brothers and sisters, you must have heard these objections all over the place, and sometimes they may have come to your mind too. Well, of course, Islam is a practical religion. The old aged people, the sick, those who are traveling, the pregnant women, and the nursing mother, all such people are exempted from fasting during the month of Ramadan. Some of those people have to make up the days they have missed when their situation returns to normal, while some are exempted totally. And for that, of course, we have jurisprudential laws. But this picture that gets painted, oh, Islam is forcing Muslims to do this. Islam is, you know, making it compulsory and mandatory. And hence, the result is Islam is so bad, Islam is so dominant, so controlling. No, brothers and sisters, it's nothing like that. If you go and ask Muslims, do a survey, they take it as an opportunity to get closer to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And we know for us to be able to gain anything in this world, we've got to and ought to give up on something. It's not that simple that, oh no, I'm not going to give up anything, yet I want proximity of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. No, Islam is a logical religion. As the Quran says, Allah desires ease for you, and He does not desire for you the difficulty. Chapter number 2, verse number 185. Now, okay, fine. You mentioned a few exceptions and a verse, right? One can say another objection I'm trying to raise here. So based on this verse, I can simply skip fasting as I find it difficult. Remember, like we said, Allah wants ease and desires ease for you. No, brothers and sisters, you cannot simply skip it if you fulfill the conditions under which Allah has prescribed fasting for you. This is a done deal, because we are, at the end of the day, the servants of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, not the servants of our desires, not the servants of our own whims and wishes. We serve Allah. See, you're forcing me again. As soon as we say that we serve Allah and Allah wants us to keep fasting in the month of Ramadan, this is another objection that can surface up, that you're forcing me again. Let me answer that after the break. Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we are talking about some of the objections that sometimes our youth, you know, they have in their minds, or they get to hear from some places, that Islam is forcing its followers to stay hungry and thirsty, and, you know, hence Islam is not very good religion. We answered that. And then somebody can say that, okay, if Allah wants ease for me, then, you know, I find it difficult to fast, so I can just skip it, right? And we said, no, you can't. And then another follow-up objection would be that if I can't, then where's the ease? Brothers and sisters, I can simply skip fasting if I qualify to be in the category that Allah has provided exemption for, right? You cannot simply skip the fasting if you fulfill the conditions under which Allah has prescribed fasting for you, right? So it seems like forcing to you, right? Let me give you one example to clarify this point. Sometimes parents make us do something and we feel forced into it till we grow up and realize how important that thing was for us. Isn't that right? Take an example of studying, for instance. Now, honestly, how many of us like studying from our childhood? You know, how many of us were excited to learn new things, to learn chemistry, biology, mathematics, you know? We all know that we were not and never super excited about all of the subjects, and we didn't want to learn everything. But our parents put us through the education system for us to be able to study. Right? The parents, the teachers, and other wise people continued to advise us to study well. Did you ever think why? Brothers and sisters, Allah is the most wise. Through His limitless wisdom, unlimited intelligence, he prescribes fasting for us. Is it wise for us to not benefit from fasting? Think about it. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
In the limelight. In the United States, Ali Alexander, who was a key figure in the Stop the Steal movement, said he had received a grand jury subpoena and would assist the expanding Justice Department investigation. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Alan Feuer. The piece is titled, Pro-Trump Rally Planner is Cooperating in Justice Department's January 6 Inquiry. Ali Alexander, a prominent organizer of pro-Trump events after the 2020 presidential election, has agreed to cooperate with the Justice Department's investigation of the attack on the Capitol last year. The first high-profile political figure known to have offered assistance to the government's newly expanded criminal inquiry. Speaking through a lawyer, Mr. Alexander said on Friday that he had recently received a subpoena from a federal grand jury that is seeking information on several broad categories of people connected to pro-Trump rallies that took place in Washington after the election. In a statement from the lawyer, Mr. Alexander said he was taking a cooperative posture with the Justice Department's investigation, but did not know what useful information he could give. He also disavowed anyone who took part in or planned violence on 6th of January 2021. While it remains unclear what Mr. Alexander might tell the grand jury, he was intimately involved in the sprawling effort to mount political protests challenging the results of the 2020 presidential election and had contacts with other organizers, extremist groups, members of Congress, and, according to the House committee investigating the 6th of January riot, White House officials during the period after Election Day. The grand jury, empaneled by federal prosecutors, is looking into a wide range of issues surrounding former President Donald J. Trump's efforts to overturn the results of the election, after months in which the Justice Department focused on rioters directly involved in the storming of the Capitol. In early December, Mr. Alexander voluntarily sat for a deposition with the House committee and gave it a trove of documents that help shed light on the activities that preceded the Capitol attack. Grand jury subpoena Mr. Alexander received suggests that prosecutors have greatly widened the scope of their inquiry to include not only people who were at the Capitol, but also those who organized and spoke at pro-Trump events in November and December of 2020, and on 6th of January 2021. In an indication that the inquiry could reach into the Trump administration and its allies in Congress, the subpoena also seeks information about members of the executive and legislative branches of the government who were involved in the events or who may have helped to obstruct the certification of the 2020 election. Mr. Alexander took part in two so-called Stop the Steal rallies in Washington that preceded the former president's event at the Ellipse near the White House on 6th of January 2021. One on 14th of November 2020 and the other a few weeks later on 12th of December 2020, as well as events in the key swing state of Georgia in December. In the run-up to those gatherings, Ali Alexander came into contact with a host of rally organizers and with right-wing groups like the Oath Keepers Militia and the First Amendment Praetorian that provided both public and personal security at the events. In the statement from his lawyer, he said he did not coordinate any movements with far-right extremist groups at his events. Ali Alexander also had a permit for an event on the east side of the Capitol on 6th of January 2021 that never took place because of the violence that erupted on that day. In the days and weeks before the rally, he was in touch with people in the White House and members of Congress, according to the House Committee's letter seeking his deposition. Mr. Alexander has said that he, along with Representatives Mo Brooks of Alabama, Paul Gosar of Arizona, and Andy Biggs of Arizona, all Republicans, helped set the events of 6th of January 2021 in motion. "We four schemed up of putting maximum pressure on Congress while they were voting," Mr. Alexander said in a since-deleted video posted online, "so that who we couldn't lobby, we could change the hearts and the minds of Republicans who were in that body, hearing our loud roar from outside." Ali Alexander declined to answer any questions about his ties to the White House or members of Congress. He also declined to discuss whether he came up with the idea of marching to the Capitol himself, or the notion emerged from conversations with others. While Mr. Alexander is the first pro-Trump political organizer to acknowledge his cooperation with the government, several far-right militants, including members of the Oath Keepers Militia, have also reached cooperation deals with prosecutors. Those Oath Keepers working with the government could help prosecutors with the sprawling seditious conspiracy case that was filed in January against the Oath Keepers' founder, Stuart Rhodes, and 10 other members of the militia group. At a court hearing in Washington on Friday, a leader of a North Carolina chapter of the Proud Boys also announced that under a plea deal with the government, he would cooperate with the Justice Department's investigation of 6th of January riot. The Proud Boys leader, Charles Donahoe, was charged in a conspiracy case with five other Proud Boys, including the organization's former chairman, Enrique Tarrio. In court papers released after the hearing, Mr. Donahoe admitted that several leaders and members of the Proud Boys had discussed using force and violence to disrupt the certification of the 2020 presidential election results, to show Congress that we the people were in charge. The papers also say that the Proud Boys were discussing storming the Capitol before going to Washington in January, and that Charles Donahoe believed the attack on the building would achieve the group's goal of stopping the government from carrying out the transfer of presidential power. One subject that Ali Alexander might help prosecutors better understand is the bitter rivalries that often divided the small group of planners that put together pro-Trump events in Washington after the election. When he testified to the committee, Ali Alexander told congressional investigators that he faltered poor planning by organizers like Amy Kramer and her daughter Kylie Kramer, who ran a group called Women for America First that helped set up Donald Trump's event at the Ellipse. He said, for example, that leaders of the Ellipse event removed instructions from their program, telling attendees exactly where to go and what to do after the gathering concluded. Mr. Alexander might also be able to shed light on some of the activities on 6th of January 2021 of a man he considers to be something of a mentor, Roger Stone, a longtime advisor to Donald Trump. Mr. Alexander said, through his lawyer, that in the run-up to 6th of January, he spoke with Roger Stone about logistics and the warring factions of organizers and provided the House committee with all of his communications with Mr. Stone on the day of the Capitol attack. On that day, Mr. Alexander attended Donald Trump's speech at the Ellipse, then marched with the crowd towards the Capitol, along with the conspiracy theorist Alex Jones of InfoWars. He arrived, as he put it, in his prepared remarks to the House committee, in the early stages of the lawbreaking. But on Friday, he insisted through his lawyer that he had not observed any crimes being committed during the planning of the rally on 6th of January. I did nothing wrong, and I'm not in possession of evidence that anyone else had plans to commit unlawful acts, his statement said. After the building had been breached, Ali Alexander posted a video of himself on social media watching the crowd march on the Capitol from a terrace a few blocks away. I don't disavow this, he said in the video, which was preserved by the organization Right Wing Watch. I do not denounce this. In his statement on Friday, Ali Alexander said the video did not include remarks he had made that day, specifying that he was speaking only of the protesters approaching the Capitol grounds, and he reiterated that he did not support violence. I want to be clear now, he said in his statement. I disavow and denounce anyone who in any way planned to occupy buildings or engage in violence on 6th of January 2021.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of a speech delivered on March 10th, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the chairman and members of the Assembly of Experts. The meeting was held at the end of the ninth session of the Assembly. Some people say, you must forget about the nuclear issue because it has led to so much sensitivity and has created many problems. Well, the nuclear issue is of a scientific nature. It concerns our scientific and technological progress in the future. We will shortly not find the future, be needing the products of our nuclear energy. We will completely need it. Then, whom should we refer to? When must we begin the process to achieve it? Therefore, going without these things and showing negligence towards them is not correct. Another suggestion to get along with the US or any other power in order to be immune from sanctions. This means cutting off our political bargaining arm. This suggestion says that we must compromise with them because if we show a little bit toughness, they will impose sanctions on us. In my opinion, these would be grave mistakes. Of course, some people have put forward such suggestions over time with groundless, shaky, and erroneous reasoning, and they publish their opinions in newspapers and the like in the forms of theories, despite the fact that all their reasons were rejectable, and they were indeed rejected. And their insistence was of no avail.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today. And that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
If in the course of all these years, the people who wanted to cut off some of these arms of power were given the permission to go ahead with their ideas, the country would face grave dangers today. However, God the Exalted ordained that those individuals would not have the chance to do these things. This is one point. I mentioned that I would return to the discussion about the elements of national power. One important element of national power is the things that are directly related to the masses of the people. Things such as national unity, national self-confidence, and national hope. You who are an official in a certain organization of the country might be a self-confident person. But it might occur that you decide to do something that requires the people's help. If the people do not have self-confidence, you will not be able to pull it off.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been You've done for me through all my years.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Just days after a UN-backed truce came into force in Yemen, fears have risen over the implementation of the agreement, with key promises regarding commercial flights being allowed to enter Sana'a's international airport failing to materialize so far. At the time of the UN announcement, senior Yemeni officials warned onlookers to remain cautious about raising their hopes prematurely. Despite the warning, many Yemenis have already become excited for an end to the war.
The truce is wonderful for us and the region in general, a great thing, and we hope that the truce will last not only for 2 months, but rather permanently, because the people are tired and they have suffered a lot.
Yemenis have faced their fair share of disappointment over the years in regards to peace efforts. Multiple nationwide ceasefires have all failed, and the 2018 peace talks hosted by Sweden also failed to produce an end to the conflict. However, experts still believe the flights will begin soon.
The truce is holding very well. Reports of violations do not amount to breaking the truce. It's the usual standard violations that take place in similar situations. The Saudis have been trying to get out of this quagmire for a long time. And the big major conference in Riyadh is their way to initiate the exit out of the Yemen conflict. So I'm very hopeful that this will lead to some major break in the Yemeni conflict.
This truce, which the United Nations is already celebrating, could turn into a curse rather than a blessing for millions of Yemenis if key pledges regarding the siege are not upheld. In particular, so many will be hoping that they can finally get into Yemen to visit their besieged loved ones. If that turns out not to be the case, then it would be another additional heartbreak on top of the many already broken hearts which have been caused by this devastating conflict. Robert Carter, London.
A Turkish court has suspended Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi's trial in absentia of 26 Saudi nationalists accused of murdering the man inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. The Turkish justice minister said a red notice had been issued for 26 suspects. 20 of them were asked to be extradited to Turkey. However, the court's request was rejected, and Saudi Arabia demanded the case be transferred to Riyadh.
A red notice was issued for 26 suspects, and 20 of them were asked to be extradited to Turkey, but all our requests were rejected. Saudi Arabia later demanded the transfer of this case. Now the government recommended the court to close the trial in absentia and transfer the case to Saudi Arabia. However, the trial would continue in Saudi Arabia, and Turkey will wait to see convictions and sentences before dropping its own case.
The case will be transferred to Saudi Arabia. However, it is seen by many as if it will be closed. Saudi officials say the case is already closed and those involved were convicted. Khashoggi's fiancée Hatice Cenkiz, however, said she would appeal the decision, speaking to reporters in front of the courthouse.
Turkey is not ruled by a family like in Saudi Arabia. We have a justice system that addresses citizens' grievances. We will appeal the decision in line with our legal system.
Many believe the change in Turkey's stance is due to Ankara's bid to restore its relations with countries in the region.
After 4 years of not reaching its purpose and due to the suspects not being extradited to Turkey, to stand in front of the judge, it seems appropriate for Turkey to transfer the case to Saudi Arabia. However, the timing here serves Turkey for sure. It comes ahead of an expected visit by Turkish president to the kingdom, and as Turkey is restoring its relations with countries in the region such as United Arab Emirates and Israel.
Turkish officials had previously said that Khashoggi, who is a known critic of MBS, was killed and dismembered inside the Saudi consulate in an operation approved by highest levels in the kingdom.
Khashoggi's trial intensified the friction between Ankara and Riyadh, but it seems President Erdogan is looking for a warm welcome during his upcoming visit to the kingdom. Rahshan Saglam, Istanbul.
The latest voter polls in France have shown an almost total evaporation of a once sizable lead for President Emmanuel Macron. His edge over 2017's far-right runner-up, Marine Le Pen, is now down to just 3 points in a hypothetical second round, making the race a dead heat. France goes to the ballot box for the first round in just a few days on April 10th. Recent missteps by Macron may have alienated a French electorate which featured a 40% undecided rate just last week. Macron is being openly accused of trying to run from his record by hiding behind the unrest in Ukraine. He has refused to join any debate before the second round vote and has barely campaigned in France. With Macron's refusal, there was no typical first round debate between the 11 presidential hopefuls. Instead, every candidate sat down for a highly anticipated televised grilling from journalists, all except Macron. His decision has come under harsh scrutiny as being anti-democratic.
It just shows how much Macron is just like all the other politicians, thinking only of himself. He knows that he did not implement the change that he'd promised, and that's why he can't face anyone. I may submit a blank ballot or vote for the riskiest candidate. That may be the only way to change things.
Macron, who did not hold his first press conference until more than 2 years into his term, has long been criticized as displaying a monarchical aloofness and an authoritarian style of governance. The election campaign has been dominated by xenophobia, which then created major disinterest and now worries of record abstention. With the left still running in third place, a candidate with many far-right policies seems certain to take office.
The right wing has been exploded into different sections, and both Macron's section and Le Pen's section are stable. 2017 destroyed the other parties and also the influence of society's intermediaries, such as unions and NGOs. And maybe we'll say later that this was a bad thing, but I'm not really interested in this election until the second round.
The huge recent victory of Le Pen's counterpart in Hungary has many wondering if polls have similarly underestimated the right nationalist candidate in France. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
The West has declared the collapse of the Russian economy as its goal over its offensive in Ukraine. Moscow, however, says the sharp rise in prices of fuel, grain and other goods, as well as record inflation, hit unfriendly countries almost harder. In the meantime, Russia is reorienting its economy to new markets, and Iran is one of them. Level of trade between Russia and Iran hit a new record in 2021, surpassing the equivalent of $4 billion, with Russian exports to Iran accounting for more than $3 billion of that figure, and Russian imports reaching $967.3 million, up to 21.4% more than a year earlier. During a meeting between business circles of the two countries, businessmen and economic experts discussed readiness from both sides to increase their trade level.
Under heavy Western sanctions, Iran seeks opportunities in boosting foreign trade with Russia. The share of mutual trade between the Russian Federation and Iran is insignificant, but our responsible persons have a serious determination to increase this share. Our goal is to increase trade with Russia to at least $10 billion. This is in the short term.
Meanwhile, entrepreneurs from